Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Willow, Alaska, and on the line is our host, Hugh Neff, calling in from Tok. Hugh, how are you doing?
Oh, just doing great. This is actually the first show, I believe, that we've done from the kennel out here, and I'm just looking out at the sun coming over the mountains. It's reflecting off the trees, you know, that yellow hue. And then the ravens flying around, the dogs just got done eating a little while ago. So it's pretty neat to actually be talking to you while being able to tell you what it's actually like here in the dog yard.
Hey, it sounds awesome. I've been up there myself. It is an absolutely beautiful place. And for our listeners out there, Hugh has a kind of a bad connection, so bear with us. It'll come in and out. But we're going to do our best. That's kind of the life of a musher. You got to deal with what you have. So, Hugh, what is going on today's show, The Gypsy Musher?
Right now is get ready for Quest Food Drops to do this weekend. So just getting all of our different trail items assorted and organized and bagged. And it's nice, to tell you the truth, because I don't think we'd be running dogs, that's for sure. It's about 40 below here, and this is, you know, the weather when the dogs are running around in the yard playing. But to really run them too far on the trail really isn't advantageous at all for you. As far as keeping weight on them, taking, you know, their feet, you know, it's a little bit more tough on them in this weather. So it makes more sense to just have them play around the yard on days like this.
You know, that's what we're doing here, too. It's minus 24 here, and it's pretty much been that way for a couple of weeks now. And we're doing pretty cautious runs every now and then just to make sure we keep that weight on them here at our kennel, because I understand what you're saying. Dogs can lose a tremendous amount of weight exerting all that extra energy when it's very cold outside. So I'm sure a lot of mushers will understand exactly what you're saying. So you say you're getting ready for the Yukon Quest. I know that's about 2.5 weeks away. You're setting up your food bags, your drop bags, and all that stuff. We talked about that a week or two ago, right before the Copper Basin. Has anything changed in terms of what you're planning for, or are you still on the same task?
We just still got a lot of extra food drops, of course, from Copper Basin that I can use now that we got back after the race finished. As far as the – can you hear me okay, Robert?
Yeah, you're all right, yeah.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, as far as, the race one with Copper Basin actually worked out great for me. Unfortunately, overall, it's, you know, it wasn't very awesome, you know, to have a race not completed because of, trail issues and all that. But I had some newer dogs that I had just recently got back from Annie Lake that I was trying out, and they really didn't have very many miles on them. Only two girl dogs, veterans of the Iditarod and Quest, and so, necessarily only going 100 or so miles wasn't that bad a deal as far as them not being have to be pushed as far. Situations like the Copper Basin happen, and you just have to try to stay in a positive direction and not get too bummed out. You know, it was difficult on everybody involved, and it was nice to see that most of the mushers took the high road as far as, you know, realizing, you know, the folks in charge of the race did what was best overall. I mean, it was just a difficult situation for everybody.
You know, I have one question in regards to the Copper Basin and rookies qualifying for Iditarod with it being canceled. I know that's kind of a unique situation with them canceling the race, but can you give us some insight on if you're a rookie and you're planning on running the Copper Basin and that's going to be your last qualifier before you sign up for the race in June when the rookies and everybody else is allowed to sign up for Iditarod, and then you get there and the race becomes canceled and the other 300-mile races are filling up if they aren't already filled. What would you say to those guys as a veteran musher on how to proceed if, you know, they're kind of putting all their stakes in this last race here pretty late in the year, then all of a sudden they're kind of stuck without being able to qualify? Can you share some insight on that?
Oh, I just, you know, I feel for them. I, my older Elder Musher, not really an elder, but just a guy who's been around a while, Jim Lanier, you know, his first race was the Iditarod. So a lot of those guys, that was their first race, big one. And you wish they could figure out a way to think through the situation to make it these people put so much money coming from Russia, Norway, all over the world, and have stuff like this happen, I don't know. It's just difficult, and yeah, it's an expensive you know, lifestyle, sport, hobby that we have, and it'd be nice if we could all accommodate the, in some way, the people that we know have been mushing for years, like this fellow in Russia, or I can't remember the kid's name from Norway, but he is a great musher too. It's a real nice looking team, and just, you know, they have these newer mushers sign off with mentors now that, you know, give a positive word or two about who they are and how their expertise in mushing is. But it's a tough situation, and I think this sport has to look at the overall health of the sport and to try to accommodate and get as many people, into the bigger races and not just have all the events be about rules and regulations these days. And you just wonder, you know, this isn't the only time this has probably happened. It's not the only time it is going to happen. It's just tough. And I personally think, I don't know, I'm not in charge of these events, and Lord knows what a lot of people who run these events think about me and my big, you know, city boy mouth. But I think maybe unleashing the restrictions on number of teams might be an idea. They could make room to sneak in a team or two more, even five or ten more teams in some of these checkpoints. It might be packed, but there's more money going into the purse. Just the bigger the adventure for all of us. If we have, it's nice to meet these folks from all over the world. It means so much to do. I did it on a request, and it's really tough to see them have to deal with these situations. And it was neat for me in some respects that I got to meet these folks. I got to hang out a lot with a lady that Lance is helping out this year, to see her spirit. You know, she's been going through some difficult personal situations physically, and to see the this energy, this passion for what you know, our sport and lifestyle is all about, diminished just because someone not being allowed the chance to qualify. That's what really stings, I think.
So you mentioned that a good idea would be to add teams, and you say, yeah, it could get crowded at the checkpoints, but it could also benefit.
A lot of people drop out anyways before the race even starts. They sign up on their internet or on the phone, and then they wait until the last minute to drop out, and then I would have done Connect 200 a couple weeks ago if I knew there were a couple open spots. I looked into it, and I thought there was a 10 or 15 musher waiting list, and then I saw they didn't even fill up, so I don't know, it's tough.
Yeah, exactly. I was in the same boat as you. I was raring to go for the Connect 200, and like you said, that it was exactly what you mentioned. So, when you talk about a pool of mushers and teams, and something as bigger of races like the Copper Basin or the Connect 200 or one of those, what do you think that is a realistic number for mushers? Because I know in Iditarod they have a rule about you know, you have to be competitive, and if you're lagging too far behind, that they can scratch you or have you withdraw. Do you think that comes into play with some of these smaller races because of rules like that, or is there another reason?
Possibly. A lot of it has to do with accommodations at the checkpoints, whether they have enough room. These bigger races, I don't know. My feeling on racing, to be quite honest, as the years go by, and I remember I used to be in such an awe of guys like Swenson and Jeff King, and I could barely even talk to them, you know, because they were the great outdoorsmen and King of Alaska and all that. But you don't race because you're wanting to be on the trail with so-and-so. I don't. I think we're all human, you know. You're out there for the dogs and for Alaska. So if they have to even have two tiers of mushers, we've talked about it before in the Iditarod, where a second tier of less competitive mushers go out a little bit farther, a little bit later in the race, maybe that's not such a bad idea. I don't think these newer mushers or, you know, people that haven't been around the scene as long should be too worried about having to be on the trail with some famous musher. That's not what it should be about. It should be about being out there with your dogs and enjoying the life. And so maybe that's a thought in the future, is you might have to have a bit of a gap between, different stages of maybe the newer mushers go on a little bit longer. But yeah, I understand how rookies want to try to, you know,
run with the big
one person that shocks the world that wins the race. But let's be real here. Not too many rookies have won too many races in the past 10 or 20 years, haven't they?
So can you give our listeners a little bit of insight with that? When you said that they want to run with the big boys, you know, the Lances and the Hughes and the Rick Swensons and the Jeff Kings and all that, how often do you guys see each other on the Iditarod? You know, you're so spread out, you know, the number of hours potentially between the beginning and the end. How often are you guys communicating with each other out there on the trail or in sitting down having coffee or whatever?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's typically, you know, before races, we've really been, you know, we're all in our own little worlds getting organized. You don't even talk to each other. But on the trail, you know, one of my fondest memories is talking to Jeff King and Jack Tulick during that huge windstorm a couple of years ago about John Muir and transcendentalism. That was pretty amazing little chat I had. I really like to, you know, pick the minds of some of the greats, and obviously he's one of them. But, you know, Lance and I have shared over 10,000 miles together. We've been doing, you know, at least beginning of the races in the middle, we hang out a lot, and then towards the end, you know, he has a habit of leaving me in the dust as well as anybody else. You're not necessarily doing it just to be chatty with people. And I could see why he'd want to hang out and maybe take a peek or two of what everybody else is up to. But when you're worried about what every other musher is doing, then you're really missing the focus on what you're all about. So if you want to learn from other mushers, go run some videos, read a book. I mean, there's so many great books out there about mushing, and not you have to necessarily believe everything that's written in that book, but there's some pointers you can learn. And there's tons of Iditarod videos and cool stuff out there. So as far as mushing on the trail, it should be about you and your team and enjoying life and, you know, being competitive, but realizing that a lot of us that are getting, you know, to be a little bit better at what we do, we've been doing it for a long time, and we've seen a lot of miles and experienced a lot of different scenarios, and that's a key to, obviously, anything in life is getting out there and testing who you are and what you're about.
So if we could switch focus a little bit and talk some about the dogs, whether we talk about it on the Copper Basin or just in the weather in general, can you share with our listeners about what it's like for the dogs if you're running on trails or in a race when it's zero, then it's minus 20 to minus 50. What you have to do differently for the dogs at those different temperatures? I know that in the Copper Basin, a lot of the dogs were wearing the gaiters and that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that, Hugh?
Definitely seems like when it's colder out, you enjoy running a little bit more when the sun's out. And when it's warm out, you like to be out there when the moon's out. So a lot of it's all about the weather. Jackets, obviously, when they get colder, keeping all the frost off them when they're resting, going over their flanks, their feet, you know, body parts. Everything's a lot more susceptible, so you have to be a little bit more careful. Not a little bit, a lot more careful when it's colder out. You know, decent straw, lots of fluids, very underrated water when it gets colder out. Dogs tend to get a little bit more finicky as well. So if it is cold out, and you're in your dog yard, and you're not running your team, that don't mean you can't exercise the animals. Let them loose in the yard to play. Give them some time out there, just going around the yard, you know, hanging out with them and petting them up and loving them up. So colder weather, definitely you're going to be a lot more attentive on your animals. And I would say warmer weather is actually probably in many respects a little bit dangerous as well as far as them overheating. And so for me, 20 below is awesome, dude. This weather, 40 below, you're starting to feel it. Definitely on your face. The Arctic air, especially on the coast of Alaska, it has a little bit more of a harsh crispness to it. It's tough on your breathing. You know, the dogs, I'd say, are a lot more in tune with nature than humans are. You as a person have to know how to dress properly and make sure you're not sweating too much. I goofed up on this race and pulled into packs and just covered in sweat, and everybody is joking about you, what are you wearing cotton for? And I definitely was not wearing the proper underwear that was breathable and stuff like that is, you know, what I'm going to remember for these long races. I like doing mid-distance. It's fun to see different parts of Alaska, but for me, if you're going to do all that packing stuff, I would much rather be out there a week or so than just a few days.
Right, right. One other question in regards to the temperatures and possibly the health of dogs. What about viruses and things that kind of shoot through the kennel during races, after races, that sort of stuff? How do you deal with that? I know I often hear that. What's that?
A lot of people actually get their dogs into these earlier races just to get them around other teams in case there are other viruses in the air. Kennel cough was really bad in Iditarod last year, and it was brought over from some teams that were in the Quest 300. Now we have rules about you have to have certain, you know, kennel cough vaccine and stuff of that nature for the protection of not only your team, but the whole health of the whole dog field. That's why I tend to, I don't know why I do this, but I'm always like this. Whenever I go anywhere, parking lots, shopping, I always try to park away from the crowd, over in the corner of the lot, even if I don't have dogs necessarily in the truck, just because I'm not good with traffic, so I like to get out of there as fast as possible. It's the same thing with dog teams and races. Sometimes you're forced to be, you know, right up against other teams, but if it's not looking pretty as far as if you hear another team coughing, possibly don't stay as long in that checkpoint or ask one of the officials if you could possibly be moved. But realistically, in some of these races, you're sort of boxed in, and if you're going to be camping, you're going to be camping. But if you do, you know, if you're next to another dog team and another, say, dog in that team is coughing, other musher might be a little groggy or tired. You might want to just, you know, don't scare them or anything, but go, hey, I heard your dog cough. I'm not sure if you knew about that or not. You know, because it's got to share the knowledge with each other on the trail if you want to do it. That's why if you have a team coming up behind you that you know is faster than you, you don't try to start kicking and going faster and, you know, try to get away from that team. They're faster than you. Be realistic. Let them go by you, and then you can trail off of them. Stuff like that, more mushers, and I still sometimes get a little bit too competitive. And you have to realize, like Jeff King would always tell me, look at the big picture. Don't worry about the right what's happening in the moment. You got to think about maybe a day or two down the road on the trail.
That's a great point. And you talked about kennel cough there. In your experience, is kennel cough enough of a detriment to cause a dog to drop at a particular period, or is it just one of those nuisance type of illnesses that you deal with?
I mean, yeah, it's a nuisance. Sorry for talking over you, but it's, you know, look at Hans. He had it there last year. I did it right and got through it and ended up in, third place, so he did great with that, overcoming that. And it, you know, it's the magic word for I did it right is perseverance, and in races, when this happens, you need to maybe take it down a notch and realize, hey, you know, this one's just not in the cards for me this year, and maybe I'm just going to rest my dogs a little bit more, hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it takes, and have a nice-looking team that comes in 10th place than a trash team that comes in 7th place. And throughout the years, you learn through experience that the way the team looks at the finish line, it's going to impress some people just as much as what place you come in.
Hugh, what is the race that's going on this weekend? I saw on Facebook that Martin and his group are heading over that way. Is it the Cusco 300 or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you trying to bum me out?
Oh, no,
I'm just there to tell you the truth, man. Those are my buddies over there in Bethel and that area, and I really wish I could have been there, but I've got a lot going on as far as getting organized, you know, for the Quest and coming back from Copper Basin. Funny thing, when I was leaving Glen Allen yesterday to get back up here, I got a flat tire, and then right before I'm getting ready to go in town today to do this show, I look out of the truck and I have a different flat tire. So, you know, we're always being tested, and the punchline to that joke is that I was driving in town to my buddy Tom's house to give you a call, Robert, when the whole time I could have just been calling you from this phone. So I guess I've worked out in the long run. It just means I have to change another time at 40 below, which isn't much fun at all.
Absolutely. And talking about the Cusco and the Copper Basin, can you describe the differences between those two races? What makes those two races unique?
Oh, well, just weather. You know, it's warmer down there. One year, a few years back, it's called the Cusco Swim, and Kathy Chapito and Martin's wife actually made some really cool shirts with, like, trail markers floating down the river. It was a foot or so of water that we had to go through. It was like 35, 40 bucks. It was pretty warm up, but it was dangerous, man. And it can be like that down there in the southern, southwestern part of Alaska. But it's a beautiful country, lovely people, just a real sense of you being in a special event when you're at the Kuskokwim, because they really give it their all. It's an amazing culture down there. And plus my boss from NEA, who sponsors me in the Teachers Association, she's from down there at Bethel, Bethel and Gaiac, and so I have to always put in a good word for Bethel, and I wish I was there, but unfortunately we have to pass out this year. As far as mid-distance racing goes, a lot flatter terrain there compared to Copper Basin. More of a good training for the Quest, where Cusco, you see more of your top five rock teams going. Realistically, for me, though, I'd say overall the best without question mid-distance race is the Kobuk 440. Just because I love all my friends out in the Kotzebue area. They're great people, and they're always smiling and happy, and it's just a little bit longer of a race and warmer, too, in the springtime. But they're both so challenging, and I made my big mistake last year because I did an interview before the Quest, and I said, oh, the big difference between the Quest and Iditarod is the Iditarod, they're guaranteed to see wind, and in the Quest, you never see wind. And lo and behold, in last year's Quest, it was just windy the whole race. So the way the weather is nowadays, you know, every day is an adventure in Alaska when it comes to Mother Nature.
And one last question in regards to that race is, I know you have to fly all of your dogs out that way. Can you give our listeners an idea of how much something like that costs to fly an entire team out to that area of Alaska?
A lot of the more famous mushrooms, those guys are all sponsored by airlines, which is probably the greatest sponsor you can have. One of them. In Alaska, because of all the flying we do with the dogs. But basically about $2,500 to $3,000. You have to obviously have airline kennels, and then you put them on, you know, one of the air carriers, and there's a variety to choose from. And it's stressful. It can be a hassle. You got to go drive down to Anchorage and all that, and there's a lot involved with it, but it's more than worth it. I mean, it's the real Alaska. I always tell people, if you want to see the real Alaska, you got to get off the road system, get out in the bush, because that's really where it's at. And even though I love, you know, Copper Basin and some of the races around here, my biggest races that I really enjoy are Cusco, Kobuk, you know, stuff when you're way out in the middle of nowhere. They got a race going on in Uniluk this year that's going to be pretty cool. Paul Johnson, the mayor of there, Minneas, is probably going to start this race in his honor. And wish I could do that one too, but unfortunately that's during the Quest, so maybe next year I'll be doing that one. It's expensive. It's a project that you might not want to do on the spur of the moment. You might want to look into it a year or two. You have to have a good, solid veteran team, I'd say, too. You don't want to be going out to these races with a bunch of yearlings or, you know, pups. And that was part of my thinking in doing the Copper Basin this year, that I had some newer dogs and didn't have as many miles on them and some younger dogs. And that's why I thought a race like Copper Basin could be a little bit more mellow in, wouldn't be as expensive, and get some still solid training on them.
So 2.5 weeks or so from the Quest, any changes that you're making in terms of training? Are you going longer miles? Are you increasing the distance that you're going, that sort of thing, leading up to the bigger races? Or are you just kind of keeping on the same old path that you've talked about since October?
It's funny, right? When you said the word Quest, Annie's on the bed over here looking at me, and her ears just went straight up like she heard that word. She knew
awesome.
What it means. I'm holding her back for Iditarod, of course, but her brother Walter will be there with the Warriors, and he's the boss for the Quest. He's looking good. Definitely realizing after seeing the Copper Basin race that I'm going to have to, once I get these foot drops taken care of, do maybe a run or two out the chicken and get the team a little bit more solidified. These boys have some really, really nice-looking dog teams this year. Brent Sess, like I was saying earlier, one of the shows, has got the attitude, and he's got the dogs to match. And it's why I'm not necessarily all about gotta win. It's about, you know, just hanging with the boys and trying to, you know, have some fun and see how they look later on in the show and getting all pumped up before the race even begins. But I'm looking, you know, typical Hugh Neff team I always put together. You want solid veterans with a couple youngsters that have that exuberant attitude that you, I think you might want a few of them in all your veteran teams. Most of the veterans get a little bit bored. I don't know if the word is bored, but I think the older dogs get a kick out of watching younger dogs do goofy things. So I always like to have a mom with a few other pups in the team or something like that. But just a couple of longer runs for the quest, nothing too major. These dogs already have lots of miles on them. And just making sure they have solid bodies, lots of meat on it, and, you know, taking care of the feet and just keeping them fresh and happy. A lot of it's all about, you know, attitude, you know, no stress. I remember my buddy Ray Reddington told me earlier this year, I can tell how you tend to do okay year in, year out. It's not because of any, you know, special, secret I have. It's just that I try to stay upbeat and positive, and that's how you get through, you know, tough times on the trail, because we're all going to be tested out there, that's for sure. There is no such thing as any, you know, musher that has it easier than any other musher. We're all going to see our parts here and there. It's being prepared for those parts that's going to determine how you do in the long run.
Speaking of secrets, in the Copper Basin, they had a couple of mushers from, like you said, one was from Russia, another one was from New Zealand, different parts of the country. One was from South America somewhere. Have you noticed any changes in how they do things compared to us? I remember back in the day, the Norwegians, Robert Sorley and those guys, they had a different way of mushing compared to a lot of guys in the U.S. Are you seeing any changes that those guys are doing different than we do here in the U.S.?
I didn't really see them that much on the trail. I saw the Norwegian fellow. He had his own dog. So a lot of these folks, you know, rent dogs from Alaskans, like Vern Halter has the team with the fellow from Brazil. And it was interesting. I spent a little bit of time with Vern on the trail going up one of the mountains there. And when I did my first itinerary, Vern Halter was, I traveled with him like all the way to Unalakleet, and I used to drive him crazy because, you know, he's a very he has a very nice outfit, put it that way. And anyhow, I would always ask him, like, when we got to Shaktuluk, I'd be like, okay, Mr. Halter, which checkpoint is next? And I remember him saying, he looked at me and he goes, boy, you are green. And it's funny for me now, because now I'm getting, you know, this will be my 20,000 miler coming up here, and now I'm looked at as one of these people that's an old timer or whatever, even though I don't really feel like one. But so all these kids sort of look up to me as a guy that's been around a block or time or two. And the beauty of it is that even though guys like Vern or Jim Lanier or Sonny Linder, guys like that, they've been doing this a lot longer than I have, they still have that boyish passion in them, and that's why they keep coming back year after year. So these folks from Norway or Russia, I end up half the time asking them, you know, hey, can I come visit? Because I want to see other parts of the world, too, just like what they're doing. And that's the neat thing, but it is very expensive. So I think for folks that are coming from another part of the world, you have to do it like they're doing it. You have to spend the whole winter here instead of just showing up a couple days before the race.
Right, right.
As far as folks from other lands go, you know, people talk about Team Norway and all that, but there is only one Robert Sorley. That's the way I look at that.
Have you found that any of those guys have a disadvantage in terms of language barriers or anything like that on the trail with the Czech?
Oh, yeah,
there's
one of the Russian fellows that I'm not exactly sure if he was Russian or from what part of that area he was, but they're from that general area. He couldn't speak at all. And so his buddy was he was relaying messages back and forth. But that being said, you know, if you know anything about the Russians or, like, some past mushers in the quest, like, who am I thinking of? Andre, the fellow that almost beat Bruce Lee that one year. those guys, you know, they might not know how to speak English, but that doesn't mean they don't know how to, you know, understand English. And so you have to be you know, selective with your words, because they're learning from you. There's a lot more you learn by through your eyes than you do your mouth.
Especially mushing dogs. It is not necessarily a vocal sport, is it?
Oh, I mean, how often have mushers said they're going to do one thing on the trail? And it's all on videos, even the specialists at Iditarod. Those folks that were trying to be the first to the Iditarod checkpoint, and they're all saying, oh, I'm going to rest for so long. And then they realize, hey, I might be the first to the checkpoint winner. And they all start racing a couple hours later. So, yeah, just because the musher says they're going to do one thing doesn't mean they're not going to change their mind real fast. So, I always wonder what these folks that are so addicted to looking on the internet are trying to figure out. Do they really think they know what's going on out there on the trail? Because it probably has nothing to do with what they're imagining. That's the beauty of the sport, is we all get to live vicariously what through others are doing.
And it's not mushing. Everybody does it every Sunday with football and every other week with basketball and baseball and everything. Everybody's an armchair fan, at least to one thing or another, aren't they?
Yeah, and that being said, it's fun to be a fan, but, you know, if you're going to be a fan, make it positive. Don't be all about ripping into your team. Cheer for your team. And once you're done watching the game, get out there and try it yourself.
Right.
You know, mushing ain't that hard. You can hook up a six-dog team or sure check out your area. There's dog mushers all over the place.
You know, that's a great point. And if we could talk about that just a second, Hugh, you know, we didn't really have a particular topic today, so we're going back and forth a little bit, but that's what the listeners
As long as we don't forget Juanita.
We're going to definitely get to Juanita for sure. You know, you often see on Facebook and things of folks that do just have those one or two or three dogs, and they're out making videos, and they have as much passion and as much excitement as we do if we have 50 dogs in our yard, and we gotta pay some respect to those guys, because, you know, they might not have 50 dogs, but they're enjoying mushing, aren't they?
Oh yeah, my buddy Bruce Dykstrom, who's a teacher in Spokane. He's got a dog I just gave him. He was up here recently. He's going to be one of my handlers for the quest. And her name is Holly, and that's actually the name of one of his daughters. And she actually wrote a book about a dog that I got from Lance named Samson many years ago. And she's only like, I don't know, 12, 13-year-old girl. She's got a published book already. So
wow.
She makes me realize that I need to get more motivated with that. But it's pretty neat because Bruce is already racing Holly. He's only had it for a month or so. And they got, you know, little small races you can do in different communities. And if they don't, you know, it doesn't mean you and your friends can't make up your own race.
Right, right. Yeah, and just get out the sled and the dogs in the yard and just go for a spin. It's about spending time with the dogs. It's about getting out there and enjoying time with your dogs. It's not necessarily always about being competitive and traveling all over the lower 48 to find a race or whatever. It's just going out there and spending time, whether it's camping or just a, you know, a quick jaunt on the local trails. Sometimes that is just as much fun as entering into a huge race, at least to me. What do you think?
And man, like, you know, they're getting hit hard in the lower 48. We complain about the cold or the snow up here, but I'm sure they wouldn't mind having it down there compared to the, you know, the hay in the field still and no snow on the ground. It's sort of, you know, your heart goes out to these folks who can't even really have races because of the lack of snow. So I hope they are just patient and, you know, maybe they can plan a trip for later in the year when there is snow. But it's tough down there this year, so... if you're in Alaska or anywhere in the north where you have good conditions, don't take it for granted. We're having a pretty darn good year as far as weather goes, I'd say.
And it'll be gone before we know it, and we'll be sitting around this summer thinking about when can we get back on the sled next year. So it never ends. It's a constant cycle. So, Hugh, we have a few minutes left, and again, we want to apologize to our listeners with the in-and-out connection problems that we're having at Hugh's place. But when you're living in Tok, Alaska, it's not the big city, so you don't have the fancy phone lines and everything like they do in the city. So just bear with us there. Let's talk about Juanita, our Sled Dog of the Week profile. What is up with her?
Yeah, folks got to realize, so I'm about 10 miles outside of Tok, and I'm at the base of a mountain Tok is a small little town of, you know, just over 1,000 people, 3.5 hours from Fairbanks. So when Robert says remote, he means remote. Juanita's, you know, sleeping right up next to her mom, Annie. She looks like Geronimo's twin sister, you know, just a beautiful, beautiful girl. And she did all the races last year, start to finish, over 3,200 miles of racing, which is, you know, she's the only one who went that far. Makes me realize that she might not be the greatest puller in the world, but she's a swing dog, and those dogs up there don't really necessarily have to pull as much as pace and keep the team at a nice, solid beat. So she's a pretty, pretty amazing girl. Got her from Annie Lank last week, and she, along with Cicely, had only been doing, you know, 6-mile runs around the lake, and I took them on a few 15-mile runs, and then they did the Copper Basin, and I took these girls who are, you know, a little bit older, 4 and 5, as an experiment, let us say, and the reason I chose to take a big break in the beginning, a 6-hour break compared to everybody else who took a lot shorter breaks. The reason I did that was because I knew they'd need it because they hadn't been on the trail as much. But they performed quite well. The other dog was Cicely that I did the quest, and I did her out as well last year. She's a dog I got from Ray Reddington that's out of Barley, that's a swirly dog. Anyhow, you know, I took the risk with them because I knew they're experienced. I knew they're female. I knew they had that toughness, you know, and I wasn't going to put too much pressure on the team as far as trying to be too competitive. And they did great. They got the attitude, you know, yipping and yiping to go when you're taking off, and that's what I'm always looking for when I'm out on the trail. She's not the biggest girl. She's only about 40 pounds. She's got white body with black markings. She's one of Annie's army, the father's Brady. And she's funny because she's just like Annie. Like when I was feeding this morning in the yard, first they had Annie loose for a little bit, and Annie was like her brother Walter. She follows me around like she's my lieutenant, you know, checking everybody out before I feed them. And then when Annie went away, then I had Juanita loose, and Juanita did the same thing like her mom, just sort of following me around. Not necessarily trying to get into the food bucket. She was just letting everybody know in the yard that she was loose and she was special, and that meant that she's up a little bit higher on the hierarchy of the dog yard. She and Jewel, my main leader, have a funny relationship. The weird thing about Juanita is that she doesn't really like to lead. Not every dog likes to lead. They sort of start looking back at you, you know, like, hey, I don't want to be up here. And so I have her in swing all the time, and she does great. And then usually Jewel's up there and lead. So Juanita, George, Chester, Amigo, that's all Annie's army that's going to be running this year, and they're looking good. And I doubt I'll be taking her in the quest, but she'll definitely be in the Iditarod. I'm going to have a few younger dogs in the quest, and then I think the Iditarod is a race where you want more of a veteran-type team.
Well, that is Juanita, and like always, we showcase a dog every week here on the Gypsy Musher. My last question or point I want to make you, and you may or may not be aware of this, but tell us about the Huneff Congratulations page on Facebook. Have you seen that yet?
I barely, dude. And folks got to realize, I just pay attention to, you know, I'm sort of a narcissist like most mushers, sort of. I'm definitely one. I work on my page, and I don't really go on much more than that because I've got enough going on in my world. So I'm not really sure with that page what's happening, but if you want to let me know privately or whatever, I just don't want to get too involved in the whole Facebook soap opera scene. We all see what's going back and forth in these races lately, and people getting involved with other mushers' personal lives, and to each their own, and, you know, if you have an issue with a person, send them a private message or ask permission to do something with their name. I think in this day and age, it's nice to have these people that are really gung-ho about mushing, but do it in a positive light. And, you know, we're all here because we love this sport and love the North. But, you know, let's keep things focused in a good direction.
You know, that's exactly the point I was trying to make, and that's one of the focuses, at least on my side of it, that I want to do with this show is make this sport as positive as we can. because you do see so much bickering and talk back and forth on the internet and other things. And this is an internet show, so obviously that is our medium. That's how we focus our attention. Yeah. So
and it's this in every part of the world, you know, and it's like this in most sports. But going into this year, you know what I thought, Robert? Whether you in, you know, 2012 and the Mayans and the what was written in Ezekiel and all that. Whatever happens with 2012, we all sort of figured this is going to be a pretty strange year, and it is happening. So I'm just, you know, taking it as it comes, and I just wish everybody well out there and on the trail with their dogs and whatever they're doing in their worlds. And if they want to possibly, you know, don't care for what I'm about, then that's their choice. I'm not going to think of them differently just because they think of me in a certain way. That's just not the way I look at this world.
And that's a great way to look at things. And again, I'm so grateful to have you on here every week. You know, you're getting great listenership, great feedback back and forth. So obviously somebody likes the show, Hugh. Otherwise, we wouldn't be continuing to do this every week. And those are the people you want to be around, the people that are giving you those positive comments and that positive feedback. And I think they're doing it, at least in this forum. So, Hugh, until next
time. I love doing it, man. But, yeah, my main focus with this show really is for these school kids, and
sure.
I know I've visited a lot of schools, and I know a lot of teachers follow this, and those are the kids that I'm hoping that they get some motivation to get off the couch and get out there and do something with their lives. That's why I really, kids are realizing that from listening to this show.
So what happens this week, Hugh? I know, again, we've talked about it over and over leading up to the quest. What is going on this week for the next 7 days, at least until we talk again? Anything special?
Oh, just, you know, working on the food drops. Going to do a run or two once the weather warms up here. The quest is having a purse party at the Ken Kunkel Community Center, which is next to Ivory Jack's, which is right after we drop off food drops on Saturday, I believe. And so it'd be nice to see some mushers and, you know, shoot the breeze and, you know, get everybody psyched up for another great quest this year. Just hoping the weather warms up a little bit, but hey, you know, it's Alaska, it's January, what else is new? We're just dealing with it. That's the amazing thing. People down south think we're crazy enough up here to live, but they don't even realize that we, on a daily basis, probably do 10 times as much work as they do. The average people do down there as far as physical labor. Not only taking care of the dogs, but we're preparing for 2,000-mile races at the same time at 40 below. And we're getting it done because we love what we do, and hopefully they might realize that the reason so many people love to live up north is because it makes you feel more alive up here, and you just have a stronger passion for what you do. I mean, for some of us, Alaska isn't just a state, it's a state of mind, you know. We really thrive off of not only surviving, but evolving. And that's what hopefully this year will all be about.
I think so. And like you said, a lot of us have a second job when we get home, and it's not just the mushrooms.
Exactly.
We're out there shoveling and cutting wood and digging out our houses and plugging in our cars and changing flat tires and everything like that. It is a state of mind up here, and I've learned that very quickly in the last almost 2 years now that I've lived here, and I don't think I'd want to be any place different, at least not now. So, Hugh, until next time, we're going to run out of time, buddy. We'll definitely talk again, same time. We'll definitely send links over to all of our great fans that are listening. So anything else you want to say in parting?
Just hello to everybody in Bethel. I'm going to miss you all this weekend, and good luck to everybody out there, and I'm sure it's going to be a great race because those guys are some of the best around.
So on behalf of our host, Hugh Neff, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, everywhere else. Just search Dog Works Radio. You can find us on Facebook there, too. We'll send over links of the show as soon as we get them posted to everybody that is wanting them. So, Hugh, until next time, we'll talk to you real soon, okay?
All right. Happy trails, Doctor.
Take care. So this is Robert Forto on behalf of our host, Hugh Neff. Take care.